Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Bitcoin is a relatively new asset class, and the market for Bitcoin is subject to rapid changes and uncertainty. Bitcoin is largely unregulated, and Bitcoin investments may be more susceptible to fraud and manipulation than more regulated investments. Bitcoin is subject to unique and substantial risks, including significant price volatility, lack of liquidity, and theft. Bitcoin is subject to rapid price swings, including as a result of actions and statements by influencers and the media, changes in the supply and demand of Bitcoin, and other factors. There is no assurance that Bitcoin will maintain its value over the long term. ARK strongly encourages any investor considering an investment in Bitcoin or any other digital asset to consult with a financial professional before investing. All statements made regarding Bitcoin are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or podcast guests and are not recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold Bitcoin. Historical results are not indications of future results.
Welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton, ARK's chief futurist. On this year's final episode of FYI, we'll be taking the opportunity to highlight some of the best moments from throughout the year. While we're grateful for every single guest that has joined the For Your Innovation podcast, here are some of our favorite moments. First, we chat with SoFi's CEO, Anthony Noto, and learn how he managed to diversify SoFi's product line from beyond its start as a student loan platform, and why Anthony felt he needed to purchase the rights to a stadium to grow SoFi's business. The stadium is great, the traffic to the stadium, not so much, as an aside. Next, we speak with former NBA stars Andre Iguodala and Evan Turner about their early intellectual pursuits in financial literacy and how they parlayed their experience as NBA athletes into the world of venture capital. Speaking with Andre, I think it was the first time I've spoken to someone who has won an NBA championship. After that, we sit down with the CFO of OpenAI, Sarah Friar, to discuss the scope of the AI opportunity and how OpenAI is just getting started. And it is very, very clear that AI is in its earliest days from our perspective. And you can hear how kind of OpenAI thinks about capital allocation in such a fast-moving market. Then we had the chance to pick Jack Dorsey's brain on the importance and implications of Bitcoin's open source nature and how it's truly a disruptive innovation. In fact, as I've described it, probably measured over an appropriate time span, Bitcoin is the most critical innovation in that it allows capital to flow most freely to any idea that deserves being capitalized. And finally, we hear from Shopify's president, Harley Finkelstein, on the rise of entrepreneurship globally, the critical role of AI in reducing barriers for entrepreneurs, and Shopify's vision for the future. He hints at kind of the direction that we really think that commerce is going, which is having AI purchasing agents purchase things for you. And so having an AI personal shopper, we think will change both how consumers think about buying things, but also the economics of providing a shopping platform. This is a packed episode, so get ready and enjoy, and we'll see you in 2025.
First, we have FYI episode 217 with Anthony Noto.
SoFi underwent significant growth from the time you joined as CEO in 2018 to today, right? You led its transformation from a student loan destination to a comprehensive financial super app. Can you give us an overview of your journey over the past 6 years and share how the digital wallet landscape evolved from your seat?
Yeah, and I really love your characterization as a digital wallet because I think of it in a very similar way. And you have everything in your wallet. You have access, hopefully, to all of your assets and all of your money and other important things as relates to your financial life. It really started for me in October of 17. I was at Twitter. I was the chief operating officer. we'd gone through a really tough four-year transition. And that fourth year was our first year in which we started to see an emergence of growth again. And we were going to be GAAP profitable in the fourth quarter. And I get a call from a recruiter. And I said, you know, I have no interest in leaving Twitter. We finally got to the point where I'm having a lot of fun. We're going to have great results. And all the changes we've made are really paying off. And the recruiter was very persistent and kept calling and told me that I was offending the board of directors at SoFi, many of who are people I knew, for not even looking at it. It was a CEO job and I was a COO, so why wouldn't I want to be CEO? So I finally dug into it. And as I dug into it, and this will tie back to when Kathy and I first met, it caused me to take a step back and say, why isn't there an Amazon of consumer financial services? Yes, there's PayPal and there's Square, but there's no like all one-stop shop for everything you want to do in your financial life. And the second question I asked is, would that be interesting? Would that be valuable? And the cohort of people I thought it would be valuable for were people like my brothers. They did well academically. They did well professionally. They were making $150,000 to $400,000 a year, but they were struggling to live the American dream. They couldn't have the size house they wanted or number of kids or the career or the location. And so I went to the board and I basically pitched, let's build a relationship financial services company, someone that can help me get my money right across everything I do so I can live the American dream. I can get the payoff for doing well professionally. And I explained to the board that in order to do it, we had to do everything. We had to do loans, checking, savings account, credit card, investing, insurance, because each one of those is an important cog to your overall financial profile. And if you don't manage all of them right, for example, you overpay for a house, you'll never have enough discretionary spending because your mortgage is so high to invest in your 20s. If you don't invest in your 20s, you can't catch up later. The compounding effect gets lost, and that's an optionality value that you lose. Same if you overpay for college, you'll struggle to be able to own a home, which is an important economic asset to have and an emotional asset to have. So I pitched the board on that complete strategy, which is what we've deployed since then. And then I also explained to them we'd lose $400 to $500 million the first year, a couple hundred million dollars the second year, third year, maybe $100 to $200 million, and then in the fourth and fifth year, start to get to in below $100 million. And I think I said we wouldn't be profitable until probably 2025. And we got there in 2024, fortunately. I'd say the how it's unfolded is completely different than anyone could have imagined. The first year, rates were going up significantly. Supposed to be rate increases in 18 and 19. Turned out we got to the first quarter of 19 and we went to rate decreases, not increases. We obviously had the pandemic and we've had unprecedented rate increases again. So it's been somewhat of a turbulent up and down. And the one of the things that we've benefited from is that this broad-based offering for the consumer actually diversifies our business so that we can go left when it's time to go left, we can go right when it's time to go right. And so the team's done a great job of not just building a consumer value proposition that's unique and really hard to replicate, but it's also resulted in a business mix that allows us to operate differently in different environments.
So it seems like you were right at the onset, as in your digital wallet thesis, has it changed at all from when you joined to now?
I would say some things have been harder and some things have been easier, but the thesis and, you know, I knew that in order to be successful and achieve the mission of being this one-stop shop, we would need to have a lot of capital, and that's definitely been the case, and we've been fortunate to have the capital. I think it would have been a lot harder for us to get the capital if we didn't have a SPAC IPO. A lot of the people said, Anthony, why did you go to the route of a SPAC? You did probably 100 IPOs when you were an analyst and a banker. And I said, I actually needed to raise a significant amount of capital at once with certainty in order to apply for a bank license because my balance sheet was primarily equity, was primarily preferred equity. In order to take out the preferred equity, I needed to have a meaningful valuation and a meaningful amount of capital to do so. And so that was a challenge that wasn't anticipated, but the SPAC enabled that to happen. And it was a very unique product for us and worked out quite well.
And even from a lending CAC, you keep it, you're far more efficient than, say, the legacy incumbents. How much do you attribute that to your marketing strategy? And like, how do you think about brand and performance marketing and I guess against incumbents and other neobanks?
Yeah. So I was presenting to our board in the beginning of 2019 and I said something like the plan for the year and we're going to roll out SoFi Money, SoFi Credit Card, SoFi Invest that year, SoFi Relay. And I was really proud of that. We built it all. It's about to roll out. And I said, it's a matter of when, not if. Everyone's like, when, not if, what? I said, we become a top 10 financial institution. They said, why are you so confident? You haven't even launched the product yet. And I said, we designed them to be the best. And they're going to be the best. We will not stop until they're the best. We'll run hard every day. We'll iterate every day. The only thing standing between us and actually getting there is building trust, is building a household brand name. So, you know, there's a thing called unaided brand awareness. It's measured by asking someone the question, when you want to use a financial services product, name three companies. Well, when I got to SoFi, if you asked 100 people that question, two would say SoFi. And so I did an analysis of Citi, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, Bank of America. There are between 25 and 45% of their brand, 100 people would say their names. I said, we have to become a household brand name like them. And if we do, our products will be top of mind and they'll be used. And it was literally at that moment that I said to myself, we got to do that damn LA stadium naming rights deal because it will instantly make us credible because the NFL. Also, I felt it was the most ambitious stage in the world and we'd have acts like Taylor Swift and the World Cup and the Olympics and the Super Bowl and the college football championship. And so literally from that moment on, I focused the team on building unaided brand awareness first and foremost. Yes, we need to do performance marketing to drive acquisition and acceptable vehicle. But if our brand had high unaided brand awareness, then the performance marketing would be even more efficient. People would click on our ads more. We'd rank higher in search results, et cetera. So it's always been this 25% spending on brand awareness, unaided brand awareness, and 75% on performance marketing. And it's proved out to be a great strategy. And Lauren, our CMO, has just hit the cover off the ball. And we announced this week the official bank of the NBA as another step in that process.
We have something in common there. Last week, we had our Big Ideas Investment Summit here at the new Innovation Center in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I had the pleasure and the privilege of interviewing Andre Iguodala. And
oh, yeah.
Isn't that, and honestly, Anthony, what happened was, I guess we were both in an airport somewhere and he tweeted about it, but I mean, I didn't meet him. I didn't even know who he was. And one of our Matt Stout on our marketing team called out in the morning meeting, hey, did you know Andre Iguodala tweeted at you? And I said, and everybody went, wow. I said, okay, who is he? You know, that's how terrible I am. And I'm into football much more than basketball. But we had the most amazing discussion. What a wonderful person he is. But do you know he's the president of the Players Association for the NBA?
Yeah, I think that's fabulous. You know, Andre is a great person. He's obviously a great athlete, great teammate, but he's a great father and a great investor. I've gotten to know him out here in California. We belong to the same golf course and we've had the pleasure of being together a few times and chatting about things from an investment standpoint to playing the game that we both love in golf.
Next, we have FYI episode 219 with Andre Iguodala and Evan Turner.
You would never have expected me to have this kind of, I'll say, entrepreneur, athlete for our podcast, but they are doing important things in our world. They already have, and they are now, and we're going to be working together with them in the future to do even more. So I would like to introduce, not introduce, I'd like you to introduce yourselves, Andre Iguodala and Evan Turner, and to talk a little bit, just open it up where we know now that you're into venture capital, but your journey to here from there has been, both of your journeys have been extraordinary. So we'd love to hear a bit about the journey and how it got you to venture capital.
Well, Emma's a much better storyteller than I am, so I'm gonna go first. I think we both have an intellectual curiosity to us from a very young age. And it's interesting how we became teammates in Philadelphia and having to maneuver around that environment and the sentiments of being a professional athlete, the perception that's placed on you depending upon your performance, and how it started off as like a small riff because we were in similar positions. Mm. You know, we're fighting for the same, basically the same minutes, which is the same stats, which
I'm gonna be unreasonable and very arrogant.
But it could equate to the same. You know, we're fighting for the same salary.
Yeah.
You know, there's a salary cap, and there's only so much of a threshold you can take up, and how to turn into an everlasting friendship. And I think that speaks to who we both are, yeah. and how we both think. And it's hearing his youth and how he grew up, and then myself. It was just a lot of curiosity. And the second sons of our fathers within the family.
You know, our favorite, the favorite sons.
The favorite sons as well. The favorite sons as well.
Yeah, I had like 80 kids, but the favorite, the favorite son.
But Robert Smith has a second son theory. Yeah. And we fit that mold. We look up to Robert Smith and what he's done for our community. Coming in as professional athletes, there's a lot of stigmas, stereotypes, and then being so young, 20, 21 years old, mm-hmm. you're trying to find yourself.
Yeah.
Most kids are in college. They're finding themselves. They're able to make mistakes. You know, then they're able to, you know, sleep late and, you know, their mistakes and their traumas won't come back to haunt them.
Right.
But as professional athletes, you're thrown in that fire pretty fast and mm-hmm. you're trying to figure out who you are. And you're trying to, every day you wake up a different person not realizing it. Mm-hmm. And you're constantly changing. And so one day you want to be this person. Next day you want to be this person. And so you're constantly evolving. And I think for us, we were always searching for the best version of ourselves. And you hear the horror stories about athletes who mismanage their funds. And it's not necessarily the athlete mismanaging mm-hmm. their funds. It's the folks who are actually managing
exactly.
the funds.
Exactly.
And coming from our communities, if you've never seen a bank, you've never seen a branch, you've never seen a checkbook.
All right, it's just a blessing if you make rent. So forget all the other stuff. It's like make rent. We came from a community where I just made rent. We didn't pay, cut the phone off, just cut the phone off. But it's like how far behind the eight ball you started.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And when you come from that background, how can you expect them to make the right decisions on identifying an individual who's qualified to manage their funds?
Yeah. Right.
You've never been able to identify that in your life. You know, why when you get the money, are you just all of a sudden you have the wherewithal to go select that individual? It's impossible.
Right.
You know, and it speaks to what you're doing and how you're giving those who've never had access to markets access. Mm-hmm. Similar sentiments. And so mm-hmm. for us, we were always curious and saying, okay, how can we not end up in that place? And what we learned is we just go get information ourselves. I don't know where that's come from. It's something that's innate, a blessing. Mm-hmm. That's a blessing. I can't take credit for it. But I guess it's learning from my older brother's mistakes as well.
That definitely helped.
I dodged a lot of behind. My butt whoopings, I dodged a lot because I saw the person in front of me getting whooped a lot.
Yeah.
And so you figure out how to get certain information. You get some street smarts. You're always identifying individuals who seem to have some knowledge of whatever area you're looking to learn from. And so I was always trying to surround myself by individuals who were, had a sense of financial literacy, who could help me build. And that's the long part of the story. Because from there, learn the public markets. Then you was like, what is private? What's this word private mean? Never heard of this word before.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you just go down the rabbit hole. We spoke about the rabbit hole this morning.
Rabbit hole.
And I just went down a rabbit hole.
Once you're addicted, what have the challenges been like in the venture world, and have you pulled from your life and the court, to try and conquer those challenges?
I think there's so many parallels. I think one that comes to mind immediately is, perception. And so as an athlete going into other spaces, there's uncertainty and there's doubt. And, individuals looking at you as if, what are you doing here? And so I hear so often, oh, wow, okay, so you read this. Okay, you follow this. Okay, I see you here. And just understanding how companies work and being able to apply that to, a thesis that I may put together. Mm-hmm. Or even in this role that I'm in as executive director, I'm actually going through budgets, mm-hmm. And I'm actually picking them apart a little bit. And I surprised myself because I've been on the tech side and I've seen, they're putting perspectives together over the next 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I know they're educated guesses, but if they don't hit their marks every year, the funding stops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm seeing how you stretch your dollar. You know, so when I go into a reorganization or a restructure, I can say, okay, this needs to be moved here, this needs to be moved there. But going back to the parallels, I wasn't a three-point shooter early in my career. And I was told, you know, that's not what you do. You know, you just spoke about jumping off the porch. It's like, mm-hmm. you're not a three-point shooter, so stay away from it. And it's like, no, I'm going to continue to work on this until I get good at it. And it's the same vein where someone say, I may not think I'm a good investor because I'm an athlete. I just had to prove them wrong. And so I did internships mm-hmm. where I work for free, you know,
yes.
Big like Jeff Jordan, huge yeah. fan of Jeff Jordan. You know, they call him the godfather of marketplaces.
Yeah.
And he showed me the ropes. You know, I followed him in the rooms of the boards that he sits on. You know, he's a big investor in Instacart. He's a big investor in Airbnb. You know, mm-hmm. he sits on the board of both of those companies. And then I went to Morgan Stanley, where they underwrite on the enterprise side. So I learned the whole enterprise business. You know, and they were involved in a board I sat on, Jumia, e-commerce platform. Mm-hmm. It's like the Alibaba version of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And so just learning the ins and outs of, you know, how the business is working, the margins, you know, what should the margins be depending on the sector?
Mm-hmm.
What are you looking for depending on which part of tech that you're investing in? You know, mm-hmm. e-commerce is totally different than enterprise, which is totally different than healthcare. And you're looking at all those metrics in different ways. So, you know, watching CNBC every day, watching Bloomberg every day. I always tell young people, if you want to learn something, you got to digest it as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So my brother, who's older than me, who's a finance major, one day I said to him, watch Bloomberg. Just keep watching. And the first day he said, I don't have a clue of what was said today. Didn't understand 30% of the words. I only understood 30% of the words. And I'll never forget, like a year later, we were speaking and he was like, oh, I'm watching Bloomberg. And I'm like, oh, you watch Bloomberg? He was like, yeah, this is the greatest show of all time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, same thing happened with me when he told me just turn on Bloomberg. I was just turning on in like the background. And now it's like, I'm like, bro, I'm never, ever, ever. I don't think I'll ever relate. And eventually you start picking up because anything can mm-hmm. be learned.
And you know what's about to happen next.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I learned what venture capital was, is, you know, understanding where we're going and helping build what's to come next.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think we misinform at times, or we overthink at times, or we get selfish at times. But DEI is truly making sure that everyone's involved in the process of building something, so we all have the proper perspectives and who we're serving, which is we're serving everybody.
Next up, FYI episode 241 with Sarah Fryer.
You know, in evaluating this amazing opportunity, you also had to evaluate the question we are getting all the time. You know, is this a hype cycle? You know, is this the reincarnation of the tech and telecom bubble and bust? And I know you have some interesting observations there. So why don't we start off with those before I hand it over to Brett?
I would say definitely not when it comes to the technology. So what I'm seeing in terms of our motion towards AGI, but even where we are today, it's very real. I mean, if anyone out there, if you have not yet experienced just using ChatGPT, I mean, I don't know what you're doing. The ability for it just to make your life easier from really simple tasks like, you know, what should I cook for dinner tonight? Or write me, I was sitting with my daughter this weekend, who's a sophomore in college, you know, and she needs to write a cover letter, right? Just all of these things that just make your life a lot easier. It feels revolutionary. And I think this is only when it's still in its, you know, early, early stage of what the thing will be. Do I believe that it's going to be the next big platform shift? I do, wholeheartedly. In the same way I truly believed in the shift to the cloud, and I would go to New York to meet with investors, and I would get all this pushback about how banks and governments and telcos and so on would never put their data in the cloud, ever, ever. So that, you know, there's no way the market cap of Salesforce could ever get beyond $10 billion. I feel that again, you're hearing some of that when you hear people talk about the laws of scaling are over, or there's not enough power in the world to do this. No, we are in the real beginnings of a massive platform shift. Valuations, I don't know. I leave that up to all of you. I kind of stepped out of that world, but I do love that one data point from another investor, but I'm sure Kathy has done the same analysis, saying that 2 years out from when Netscape came on the scene, right? So the first time you could really browse the internet, even have that concept, only about 2% of all of the market cap of what today we think of as internet-driven businesses existed. And I think we are that early. ChatGPT just hit its birthday. It's 2 years old. This weekend just passed. I think of investing in kind of a similar kind of way right now.
I like how you kind of drew the analogy to the cloud. And people analogize AI to a lot of different technologies. The introduction to the internet, the introduction of the computer, even the introduction of the steam engine. And yet there are also characteristics about it that are like clearly very different. It's one, compared to the internet, hey, this is expensive to serve, expensive to kind of the marginal cost of providing tokens to users is much higher than the marginal cost of providing bits to internet users, at least at the kind of platform level. How does that impact kind of like the business model and capital allocation strategy of OpenAI? Like how, from the CFO's office and also corporate strategy, like how do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't have a perfect answer, but as a starting point, often when I'm working with the team, we're focused on gross margin, not revenue as maybe the starting point. It reminds me a little bit of Square, because Square used to have this kind of concept of GPV, right, gross payment volume, and even then to gross revenue before you took out all of interchange and so on. And if you built your business to kind of GPV or to gross revenue, you could get really off. So you really had to be mindful all the time about margin, particularly gross margin. And so I think there's a lot of similarity when I think about building pricing models and so on here, that we have to look to the gross margin. At the same time, I don't want us to get too stuck that today's cost profile is tomorrow's cost profile. There is a lot of positive things happening on that cost profile. Number one, we are all just wonderful participants in Moore's Law. And, you know, as a metallurgist, as you said it, or a material scientist, I used to spend a lot of time thinking about silicon back in my university days, but Moore's Law is alive and well. I think the second thing we're all learning is massive more efficiency in how we run our compute. So, you know, as effectively a two-year-old company with the sort of scale we have, we're only now really learning how to serve that compute in a really efficient way. So our gross margins are just getting better and better on that front.
Thank you, Sarah. Leave us with as you're walking off into the sunset to allocate capital to billions of dollars of chips, where, like, when we have this conversation 12 months from now, presumably the agents will have been released. They'll be out there in the world. And what will we be looking forward to, or what do you think will be kind of like the focus of that next conversation?
So what I would say to listeners is, first and foremost, we are just at the beginning. You have not gotten left behind yet, but we are in the beginning, but you need to jump aboard because this train has left the station and is accelerating. I would tell everyone to think really critically about how are you integrating AI into your own businesses, but also into your lives, because I think often it starts personally, but how are you bringing it professionally? And whatever that level is, you now need to quadruple it and go do that. And I'm excited to talk in 12, 24 months from now about how AI is solving the world's toughest problems and just the scientific breakthroughs that we're going to see.
Next, we have Bitcoin Brainstorm number 12 with Jack Dorsey.
Yeah, I mean, just back to the question on why open source. I don't know of a faster way to spread an idea than open source. It, in its very nature, the fact that anyone can read the code, anyone can build on top of the code, anyone can own the code and completely change it, build their own system. And we've proven this over and over and over again. The internet exists because of open source. Every single device you encounter and interact with every day is built on open source. You have open source in your pocket. This call is made possible by open source. Now, all the companies utilizing it might not appreciate that, might not advertise that, definitely benefit from it massively, may not give back enough from everything that they've taken to make their product useful to people. But everything we do in this world today is at the result of some programmer wanting to learn something, being gracious enough to give it away for free in order to learn more and to learn faster and to spread an idea. And I just don't, there's no other development model that I've seen that allows such a velocity as open source. The second thing is we're talking a lot about permissionless technologies. Matt calls them freedom technologies. I'm going to focus on permission. A lot of the interactions we have in this world, we require permission from the government, from a corporation, from ourselves, maybe, in order to speak in the way that we want or act in the way that we want. But if we're going to build permissionless technologies, we need a permissionless development model. And open source is the only way to do that. You don't need anyone's permission to take the code, to change the code, to add code to it, to remove code, to build a completely separate project and distribute it to people. And I think that parallel is really important. Like, you just can't build permissionless technologies, no matter how hard you try to prove them or advertise them as such, without having permissionless development models. And then the third that I also think is critical and has been mentioned is the ownership aspect. The fact that this is not just open software, not just transparent that you can read the code, but it's normally free as well. And in many cases, that's without license, with very creative licensees to create derivative works and even build companies around those derivative works. It's not always consistent. But the fact that we have a legal structure around ownership for this free and open software is really important, really critical, and should also be defended. And it's been under attack recently. The recent Craig Wright shenanigans that we just defeated was an attack not on Bitcoin. It was an attack on the open source development model. Like, all of open source development model was at risk if he won those cases. And there will be more attacks. That's not it. There will be more sophisticated adversaries. And, you know, as we continue this discussion, it's not just about funding open source developers, but all the mechanics and the infrastructure around that, including legal defense, including policy and regulatory pushback. For people who are not, who hate this stuff, they don't want to do it with anything legal. They don't want to do it with anything having to do with policy or regulatory. So much so that we've had a number of, and Mike can speak to this, we've had a number of developers leave Bitcoin development entirely for the fear of being sued, or in the worst case, having some other penalty put upon them. So as we think about open source and what it takes to fund it in a way that these developers feel independent, like, I think it's also important to consider all the infrastructure around them and where the gaps are. And that's what concerns me the most moving forward is those gaps. Because because you can't attack the model, because it is so permissionless and free, you're going to attack where the model intersects with society and where it intersects with the law. And that's where we haven't done enough work to really define the defenses that folks need to continue this work. And if we don't figure it out, then again, the open source development model is under attack, and something that could not go away technically, but go away because no one wants to work on it because they don't want to take the risk. And that's super scary. And like, we're seeing more and more of those adversaries as we go on year by year.
May I pipe in here just in, you know, the adversaries and how they might change over time? Just for our listener base, what's gone on in the financial markets is unbelievable. This idea that the Mag Six, the Magnificent Six, would represent such concentration. They account for 45% of the average large cap growth managers portfolio. And these ecosystems, for the most part, are closed. And sort of the centralization vector and the power structure. I mean, this is typically a very unhealthy development unless something is going to change it. And what's very interesting in looking back in history, going back into the Great Depression, as new technologies were evolving, telephone, electricity, and internal combustion engine, the same concentration had taken place because everyone was afraid to invest in in almost anything. Was it going to go bankrupt with unemployment up at 25% and GDP down 30%? But what happened was these new technologies created an environment where the mega cap stocks actually started to underperform dramatically because these new technologies were taking over. And I think you've just described why or why and how we should be thinking that way now as well, and how we should protect it.
Yeah, totally. I don't think we have enough people thinking about it, to be honest. And there's certainly very, very few companies doing it. And I do think they have a moral responsibility, especially if they're working with these technologies. But you have to drag them along currently. And we just need a few more to really inspire that momentum. And I think it will compound. But I'm not just talking about the recent batch. Like, it's the Googles, the Microsofts, the Netflixes of the world, who their entire business is attributable to open source success and open source platforms. And a lot of those companies do give back meaningfully to open source. But at the size and the scale that they are, it could be a much, much higher percentage.
That's very interesting.
Finally, we have FYI episode 239 with Harley Finkelstein.
I think the headline from, you know, Q3 was that entrepreneurship is on the rise, global commerce is on the rise, and that Shopify is gaining share in a very large market. I think the thing that most investors and certainly analysts were looking for is whether we were able to deliver both on growth and on margin. And I think we did that. GMV, which is a proxy for how merchants on Shopify are doing, was up 24%. That's actually the fifth consecutive quarter where GMV was greater than 20%. It was about $69 billion. Revenue was $2.2 billion, which was up like 26% or so. Gross profit grew 24%. Operating income doubled from last year. But I think the thing that a lot of it seems like a lot of people cared to learn about was really free cash on margin, which expanded to 19%. And we're really happy with that free cash on margin because it allows us to grow the business and invest in the future. And then maybe the only other thing that I thought I was really excited to share with everyone was that we are seeing more merchants come to Shopify across more verticals, more industries, more geographies. The vertical thing is not new. We've always had, like scrub companies like Figs to, food companies like ButcherBox to companies like Gymshark that are in the apparel industry. But I think the industries was interesting. I think geographies was interesting. On the industry side, seeing more growth come from B2B, I think was really, people were excited by that. B2B GMB grew like 145%. And then larger merchants had come on. We've been working on the enterprise side for almost since the IPO. Initially, it was merchants who started on Shopify that grew really large, and we wanted to make sure they had a place to graduate to on Shopify. But in the last 5 years or so, we've seen these iconic, legendary brands. This quarter alone, Reebok, Off-White, Lionsgate, Hanes, On Running, one of my favorite brands, Victoria's Secret, all came to Shopify too. And so I think the story this quarter was a company that is able to grow the top line, grow, have great profitability to reinvest in the business, but also increase the amount of on-ramps into Shopify, not just e-commerce in North America, but rather global commerce everywhere.
You laid out kind of this vision, or Shopify laid out a vision for getting into B2B, getting into enterprise, at least a year ago. And I'm sure it's been strategic works for a while. Why is that working? Sometimes self-serve kind of businesses have trouble kind of branching into those kind of high touch relationships where they expect more customization, or they expect more kind of like maybe bells and whistles. Like, how have you been able to kind of bridge that gap?
I think a challenge is that a lot of companies that start in the SMB segment have a really tough time moving up market. What often tends to happen is they just kind of move up market entirely and they forget about that sort of SMB segment. That was never our intention. Our intention was always to kind of stretch up market. And the strategy is that, what if we made Shopify the place where everyone that has an idea in the shower in the morning starts their business? We know that not all businesses will succeed, but the ones that do, offset the costs of the ones that don't, and over time will stay with us for a very long period of time and take more of our solutions and more of our products. And it's almost like a sort of think of like an annuity that like we are still making money from cohorts that signed up with us 10, 12, 15 years ago. So we believe in the SMB segment. We think it's really important. But at the same time, we wanted to create more of these kind of growth levers on the company so that it's great when Ben Francis, who's the founder of Gymshark, when he grows Gymshark to be a $1 billion brand, the fact that he stays with Shopify, we love that. Or Trina at Figs, or you know, any of these kind of homegrown success stories, Ronnie at Kith, for example, or you know, those are amazing. But when Glossier, who famously builds a very large engineering team, decides, hey, we're a cosmetics company. We don't really need to have hundreds of engineers running our own e-commerce stack. We want to go to Shopify because we think they're going to future-proof our business. They're resilient. They understand the future of retail is retail everywhere, online, offline, everywhere in between. That's when this thing gets really interesting. And so the key from a product perspective is that the complexity of Shopify, it almost needs to reveal itself over time. It can overwhelm the small businesses because they'll never get started. It'll be, you know, it's like the paradox of choice. It's just, they won't do anything. So we wanted to make it so that you can get started, but then as you grow to become a multi-billion dollar company, you never have to leave. And what started happening, I guess in the last 4 or 5 years is that we saw companies like Mattel and companies like Staples and you know companies like Authentic Brands Group come to us and say, look, we have a business that's at scale. We just want to make sure that as we grow, we future-proof our tech stack. Meaning, when there's a new channel to sell on, we want to be able to sell there. Whether it's you know Instagram commerce or YouTube live selling or selling on TikTok or an integration to Pinterest or Spotify. And so we've really thought about ourselves as shifting from being an e-commerce provider for small businesses to really being a retail operating system for business of all sizes. And you know, specifically to your question, why is that important? It's because there's now so many different on-ramps into Shopify. Each on-ramp is a solution to a particular problem. I want to sell offline. I want to sell online. I want to sell on Instagram. Each of those are reasons people come to Shopify. But once they get onto the platform, they realize that they actually can activate more channels. They can take more merchant solutions. They can use Shopify payments, or they can use Capital or some of our financial services. And it just creates a much more durable company that isn't reliant, back to what I said earlier, on any one particular industry, one particular geography, or one particular type of merchant. So the cost of failure is really, really low. So more people are getting started. That is amazing. Certainly the data that we have seen, even simply, you know, even in the last couple of years has been quite remarkable. I mean, there is this, I think it just came out, it was the US Census Department talking about, you know, what is happening right now in terms of business creation. And the term that was in this report was like, this is the era of entrepreneurship, that never before has there been so many tools and resources available to merchants. And it just, I believe that, I see that there are more people participating now than ever before. Okay, so now more people are starting, more people realize that it's an exciting thing for them to do. They can commercialize their hobby, they can take an idea in the shower and make it available to other people. That's all wonderful. Now the question is, what happens once you get started? And this is where AI becomes really, really important. There is an unfair advantage that larger companies have relative to smaller companies when it comes to resources. So take something as simple as product photography or writing product descriptions. I had a chance to spend some time recently with Mickey Drexler, iconic retail leader. He ran The Gap for about 18 years or so. He created Old Navy. He recreated J. Crew. He was on the board of Apple, I think, for 10 years, worked very closely with Steve Jobs. And he talked about the merchandising department inside of The Gap. And it was hundreds of people. And product photography and descriptions and how things were displayed was a big part of their business. If you're a one person or a two person operation, you can't really do that. However, this is where AI can really play a role in kind of leveling the playing field, where now using, you know, our media editor, Shopify's media editor powered by AI technology, you can actually create beautiful photography. We can actually suggest, and AI can suggest, really highly converting and very compelling product descriptions. Something as simple as, I talked about this on the call today, but suggested replies in Shopify inbox, that now you can get an AI generated reply so that if a merchant asked a question, highly contextualized responses happen in real time right away with a lot of the information they're asking for, which means you as an entrepreneur can spend more time building your product and building your business. This is where I think Shopify is uniquely positioned to really take advantage of AI in a way that most other companies cannot. This is where the leveling of playing field really plays a role. You know, a major moment for me was really in 2020 during the pandemic. It felt like overnight we had kind of had to, like, everyone had to kind of move online. Every physical retailer had to move online, and not all were ready. And we scrapped our product roadmap, and instead we simply thought about, how do we add the most value right now? Like, this pandemic is unprecedented. People are scared. Merchants are losing their businesses. People need to survive. And we just started doing things like curbside pickup and touchless, you know, keypads. And I just think that, you know, companies should be evaluated not in kind of the times where everything is going well, but when things are a little bit rough, how do they operate? How do they show up for their customers? And I'm really, you know, I remember at the time Shopify Capital was only available, I think, in the US, and over like a weekend, like literally Saturday morning at 10 a.m. until Sunday afternoon, a few of us got together and figured out a way to open up Shopify Capital to Canada, to the UK, to get the underwriting set up. By Monday morning, we were able to offer capital, cash advances to way more merchants than we could on Friday afternoon. So I'm really, really proud of that. I also think that the enterprise push is really fantastic. It's amazing. I mean, you know, watching brands like Kylie and Skims start and grow on Shopify, that is awesome. But now that some of my favorite brands are coming to the company, I mean, you know, getting On Running On and getting companies like, you know, Glossier and Aloe and Barnes & Noble and Overstock to come on, I think is incredible. Like, the fact that we could help small businesses get started, but also we're enterprise grade, that we can help the biggest companies do the biggest flash sales, and it's all beautifully organized in this unified retail operating system. I don't know. Those are some of the things I'm most proud of. And I think maybe at a high level, this idea that we can do this in a way that, you know, grows the business, grows the top line, but also allows us to reinvest because we have free cash flow margins that allow us to do so. I think that's the way you build a truly long-term, you know, 100-year durable company. And this is, you know, this is my 15th year at Shopify, so more than a third of my life has been spent here. This is by far the best version of the company, the best team, the highest quality product, the most focus. I'm really proud of the company that we've become. And I can't, you know, the future is really exciting. And as you can see from, hopefully you can see from my tone and the way I speak about these things, like, we're so excited about what we're able to do here. I think that Shopify is the closest thing to the world entrepreneurship company, not just small entrepreneur, but like entrepreneur in general. That means if you're at a big company and you're entrepreneurial, or you're at your mom's kitchen table getting started, I think Shopify being the entrepreneurship company is really meaningful to all of us that work here. I mean, we're, many ways, we're a company of entrepreneurs building software for other entrepreneurs.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button and make sure to leave a comment down below letting us know what you thought. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to the show and follow us at ARK Invest on your favorite social platforms so you stay up to date whenever we drop a new episode.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.